This special broadcast of U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's address to the Alaska State Legislature is produced by 360 North in Juneau. I'm Rosemarie Alexander, KTOO News Director. In just a few moments, Senator Murkowski will be speaking to a joint session of the Alaska House of Representatives and the Senate from the state capitol in Juneau. Right now, legislators are coming into House chambers. The Senate President and House Speaker will soon gavel in the session. The annual speech will be Senator Murkowski's ninth to the legislature since she took office. She is the first woman to be elected to the U.S. Senate from Alaska and is now Alaska's senior senator. She's expected to talk about her successes in Washington and the frustrations, some of which are mighty, she has said. That includes the U.S. Air Force proposal to transfer F-16s from Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks to Elmendorf in Anchorage. Murkowski has met with the Pentagon on the issue a few times and just last weekend held a meeting in Fairbanks with General Norton Schwartz, Air Force Chief of Staff. In just a few moments, we will go to the House chambers for Senator Murkowski's speech.
In accordance with the provisions of Uniform Rule 51, I turn the gavel over to the President of the Senate, the Honorable Gary Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This joint session will please come to order. The purpose of the joint session is to hear an address by the Honorable Lisa Murkowski, United States Senator. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the Senate be waived and all members be shown as present.
Without objection, so ordered. Representative Osterman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call of the House be waived and all members be shown as present.
Thank you. Without objection, so ordered. Will Representative Fairclough and Senator Stedman please escort Senator Lisa Murkowski to the joint session.
Ladies and gentlemen, the United States Senator from the great state of Alaska, the Honorable Lisa Murkowski.
Senator Murkowski is approaching the dais, but she has been shaking hands with everyone as she came down the hall and into the chambers, and now it appears she's going to begin her speech. Oops, a few more hands to be shaken. Hands of Senate President and the House Speaker.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Gosh, that's good. I do have to comment. It really is, I think, remarkable to have, year after year, incredible staff that serve you all and serve you all well. So I'm just delighted to come back and see this team. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, to all of my colleagues that are here, good morning to you and to fellow Alaskans that are watching or listening. Thank you for letting all of us into your home this morning. That's kind of a special part of what happens with our technologies. You know that the speech that I give to you on an annual basis always starts off with the good, feel-good stuff about the family, because you just can't get away from that. I can't get away from it. None of us should be getting away from our families. So I'm not going to describe how tall Nick is this year, because I'm not tall enough to reach there, but talked with him this morning. He's a junior this year in college already, doing well, focusing on finance. This is his third summer now working on a commercial fishing vessel, on a tender, working out in Bristol Bay and down in the Prince of Wales part of the waters, second half of the summer, working hard, understanding the value of money. Not so sure about this whole taxes thing and where that all comes from. His younger brother joined him this summer, so both of them were out commercial fishing, working very, very hard. I'm very proud of them. Matt is a freshman this year. They're both in Colorado. They thought that academics would be okay and skiing would be great. Now they're thinking that they probably should have stayed in the state because that's where all the snow is, but both boys are doing very well. Vern and I are exceptionally proud of them. Vern waited until Matt was out of the house and then decided he was going to remodel and build a bigger kitchen. I'm not quite sure why, but any of you that make your way back to Washington, D.C. in a couple months, consider yourself guests at the home because Vern's got lots of kitchen that he's going to want to be trying out. But we are doing well as a family, and when you do well as a family, it allows you to do your job that much better. So I'm healthy and hearty. I'm back on skis, and that's a good thing, and we're all well. I'm joined today by some staff that you know. I think all of you know all of them, but I'm going to introduce. Ed Hild is my chief of staff. Ed has been my chief now for a couple years, doing a great job for me back in Washington, D.C. Next to Ed is a very familiar face around these halls, Jim Palmer. Jim is my deputy chief of staff. He locates out of Anchorage and really does a good job for me covering the state. Next to him is no stranger to you, a guy that I borrowed from my friend Bert Stedman, Miles Baker. Has joined me back in Washington, D.C. He has a minor portfolio focusing on the economy, jobs, taxes, and now tourism. So he is a busy man, but he has made quite an impression in Washington in very short order. Next to Miles is Andrea Gusty. Andrea may be a familiar face from Channel 11. She has joined us and is working the communications end in Alaska and doing a great job for me, and I really appreciate her. And our newest hire, but certainly a very familiar face around here, Colleen Shaw McGowan. Colleen is now running the Juneau office for me here. We just opened up the office a couple weeks ago, and Colleen has long roots with me. She worked for me when I was here in the house and then followed me to Washington, D.C., came home, got married, had kids, and now we got her back in action. So I've got a good team with me, and I'm very proud of all of them. So thank you for being here with us. So I'm keeping an eye on the clock because I want to make sure that we've got plenty of time for questions here. But to move to the prepared remarks for the morning, a lot of focus on just the chaos, really, the chaos in Washington, D.C. People say that our nation is very divided right now, and it is. But I would suggest that here in Alaska, things are different. All of us, whether we live in town, whether we live in the bush, whether we're pioneers, whether we are recent arrivals, we are joined together by our choice to live here, to live in this great and very challenging land. And we recognize that our state is what we make of it. What we do here is what it's all about. We work together, and that allows us to overcome even the greatest of obstacles, and what some might call our big miracles. And when you think about some of the news stories that have gone before us in just the past couple months, our response to the fuel shortage in Nome is a perfect example of how we overcome some of these obstacles and challenges. Getting so many federal, state, and local agencies to work seamlessly to make things happen in the time frame that was required, that was really a miracle. Pulling everybody together like that was really a miracle. Transferring fuel through a mile-long hose in harsh conditions without losing a drop, that was just Alaskans rising to the occasion. We did a darn good job. And that Alaskan can-do spirit is visible in the guardsmen who will provide security to the three provincial reconstruction teams in Afghanistan. We see it in warriors like Thomas McRae and Brandon Stone, both of Juneau. Both suffered devastating injuries while they were on duty in Afghanistan. Both came home to face incredibly challenging recoveries. And like all of our military men and women, Tom and Brandon are truly heroes and some of the bravest Alaskans of our time. And I applaud and I acknowledge not only them, but all of our heroes who serve us. And when things really seem to be at their most frustrating in Washington, D.C., it's stories like these that keep me going, remembering where I come from, who I represent. That's really what keeps me on task. It helps me to filter out the negativity, the partisanship, the personal attacks that really now characterize our national politics. Like it or not, the federal government is a constant presence in our lives. It was before statehood, it is today, and unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, it will be tomorrow. The current issue of Alaska Economic Trends explains where the funding that Washington sends to Alaska is being spent. And yet that same federal government is more than $15 trillion in debt. Cutting spending, I think we all know, is a national imperative. And Alaska is going to take its share of that hit. There's just no way around it. Since statehood, Alaska has pleaded with the federal government to get out of the way and let us grow our economy. And 53 years after statehood, the answer is still no, at least not without a fight. Right now in Washington, D.C., much of the focus is on the Keystone XL pipeline. We're doing just about everything possible to try to advance that, to try to make sure that it proceeds, despite the continuing resistance from the administration. But as I tell my colleagues back there, that's not the only pipeline that is in trouble because of politics. Our Trans-Alaska pipeline is already built, and I don't need to remind any of you how underutilized it is. Alaskans fully appreciate the need to bring new production online, and it's not just an urgent need. It is the urgent need. And I've said this to you before, last year and the year before, but I cannot emphasize it enough. Alaska can't wait. That pipeline is our lifeline. It's pretty simple. Now, many of you are probably wondering why the Senate can't seem to pass ANWR as the House did just last week. For the 12th time now, Don Young has carried that goal over the line, and yet, even with high unemployment, $100 oil, and empty treasury, we still don't seem to have the 60 votes to break the filibuster in the Senate. And if we did, I'm convinced that the majority leader would bend over backwards to keep this off the floor if we did. I do believe that I have the votes for ANWR in the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. But it will not become law unless we have a firm majority, a supportive administration, or until we have a major international calamity that shows exactly why we should have opened this years ago, why we should have opened it back in 1995 when it was vetoed at that time. ANWR will happen. And I will not give up until it succeeds. It must happen. It is simply too important to this state. It's too important to this nation. So keep working with me on that. Now, there are some other irons in the fire, and I'm making some progress on them, and it's always good to be able to report on some progress. 12 months ago, the EPA and the Corps of Engineers were blocking production in CD5 within the National Petroleum Reserve. They were refusing to permit a bridge across a remote river to provide access to the drill site. It took months of negotiations, but we are now to that point where that bridge can be built. We made our case. We didn't let up, and we won, and that's good. I'm sure you all know about the Interior Department's approved Chukchi plan last week, another point of good news for us. But, you know, the EPA has been working overtime, in my opinion, frustrating the plans to explore these leases. And a major choke point in that effort was a delay in the air permits that was costing Shell drilling season after drilling season. And we all watched and we all waited and we all hoped that it was going to happen. EPA is not going to be in a position to be the drag on that again. In the 2012 Interior Appropriations Act, there was a provision that I authored that transfers the responsibility for air quality from the EPA to the Department of the Interior. Interior has a legal mandate to bring about orderly development of offshore resources. And we saw just this past week that this is now starting to happen. Now, I know you all are reading the same newspaper that I am, and we know that there have been some groups that have filed litigation to be expected. But I think the point remains we have a better path forward. We have a better process that we can look to rather than the EPA, and that's significant. And I want you to know that as we worked to advance this initiative, the help that I received from Senator Inouye from Hawaii, he played a major role in making it happen. He reminded me that we needed to stand strong whenever, wherever the federal government treats our states like territories. His partnership with Senator Stevens lives on, and I think it's fair to say that he remains one of Alaska's best friends in Washington. So remember that next time you see him. Now, I think that our work on the Interior Probes Bill will yield us some big dividends. It's going to help Alaska foresters. It included an 18% increase for Alaska Native contract support, which is significant. We added local hire provisions so that more of our residents can work for the federal land management agencies. The fact of the matter is when you have more Alaskans working for those agencies are going to work better for Alaska. So this is important. Now, if you believe the conventional wisdom of what's going on right now, progress like this shouldn't be possible today. But we have a tendency here in Alaska to ignore conventional wisdom when it suits us, and I think it suits us. But conventional wisdom also says that in an election year, very little can be accomplished. But we can't stop pursuing those interests, those Alaskan interests that are so key, whether it's veterans' benefits, whether it's education, fisheries, transportation, public safety, tax policies, all of these must move forward. And the fact that we're in election year should not cause us to just stop and do nothing and say, well, it's an election year. We've got a job to do. We need to govern. We need to govern. Energy clearly is at the top of my agenda. The White House, the federal departments, all my colleagues in the Congress know that I'm not going to stop fighting for resource development, fighting for funding for programs like LIHEAP so that our residents can heat their homes in these tough, tough winter months. Another priority is going to be ensuring that our nation's leaders fully understand Alaska's contribution to our national security. We're seeing this play out right now with some recent decisions from the Air Force. The administration's overall strategy, I think, is properly focused on catching up with new threats in Asia and the Pacific. In Alaska, I think that we offer the most committed troops. We offer the strategic location. We clearly have the best joint training range in the world to prepare for that mission. So I think it's out of sync with that strategy for the Air Force to propose to reduce operations at Eielson Air Force Base by transferring its F-16 Aggressor Squadron down to Elmendorf. The Air Force has offered one and only one justification for this proposal, and that's cost-cutting. They say that that's the reason that we're making this recommendation. Well, I have to tell you, I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical. You know, the 2012 proposal that we're looking at right now is, in all respects, the very same proposal that was rejected back in 2005 by the BRAC Commission. Steve Thompson is nodding his head. He was there. He worked that with the Save Eielson team. It's really not that much difference. The Air Force had argued that warm basing Eielson was going to save money, but the BRAC Commission concluded that it was not going to happen. And we learned very clearly at that time that you can't maintain a warm base in a cold place. It just doesn't work. So we won that battle back in 05. But that war over Eielson continues. The proposal was wrong in 2005. I think it remains wrong today, and I'm working closely with the governor and his AMFAS team. We need to all be working together as legislators. The interior communities are coming together. We've got a meeting this afternoon to talk some more about how we move forward with this strategy. So I urge you, join with the governor, join with the delegation. Let's all come together as Alaskan communities, to wage this fight. And we can win if we speak as Alaskans with one voice in support of our network of military installations. We shouldn't pit Eielson versus Elmendorf or Jay Bear versus Jay Park. We need to focus our energy on the long-term vision of Alaska's role in the global force structure. And as we look to the future, I also continue to push the United States to lead in the Arctic. We're not leading right now, friends. We are not leading, and you know that. Unfortunately, not enough in the administration and back in Washington, D.C., no one understand that. We desperately need the funding for new icebreakers. I think we saw that our success in Nome proved their worth. I was pleased that the Secretary of the Navy responded to my request to commission the USS Anchorage, which is the amphibious landing ship in Anchorage. So when that comes forward towards the end of the summer, I would hope that we all show the kind of hospitality that will bring the Navy back to Alaska on a year-round basis. I think there are efforts that we can and should make. There is a – thanks, Max. There is a very important role for the members of the legislature in our efforts back in Washington, D.C. The solidarity that you show here, and don't smile or smirk, there is solidarity here, and I can tell you because I see it from afar. But when it comes to issues like resource development, support for our military, opposition to federal overreach, this is incredibly helpful to our cause, so I thank you. For everything that you've done in the past, I ask you to keep it up. Where you have concerns, please express them. Let me, let everyone in Washington, D.C. know exactly how you feel. I know none of us are very shy of speaking up and complaining. So let's do it. Let's work together on this. I think we're at our best. We're clearly at our best when we coordinate our efforts. So in that vein, I'm a little more interested this year in hearing from you, hearing what you've got to say about Alaska's future, what you're working on, what you're concerned about, what I can do to help. So I'm going to stun you all by stopping my comments here after, what is it, boss, were you clocking me, 15 minutes? And open it up for questions, but I will end by telling you it is an honor to serve Alaska. It is an honor to work with you, and I thank you so much for your friendship, your support, and your advocacy on behalf of the greatest state in the United States. Thank you all, and let's go to questions. Thank you. I think that applause is because I really did keep my comments to 15 minutes.
Thank you, Senator.
I'm with you.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski. It's been a pleasure to have you here, and we're glad you're willing to take questions. We'll begin with Senator Wagner.
Senator, you mentioned briefly an Arctic situation where we need icebreakers. Would you expand your comments and talk about the law of the sea? I think everybody in this room, we all understand the law of the sea. We understand the urgency. We need to have it passed. And what can we do to help you with that?
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up, Senator Wagner. This is important to Alaska. This is important to the nation. You have been helpful in the past in passing resolutions out of these chambers that are significant because that helps us make our case. Just a little bit of an update in terms of where ratification of that treaty is. I happen to believe that we have a window of opportunity this year to advance this. Now, you heard me say conventional wisdom says we're not going to get anything of substance done in an election year. I do believe that we have an opportunity to do so. Things are going to be slower this summer in terms of policy moving forward simply because of the election. So we will have floor time, which is important when you're taking up a treaty, because we're going to need a couple weeks on it. We have kind of slowed the tempo down in terms of the advocacy to kind of get on the other side of the year. And we're going to be seeing committee hearings coming up in foreign relations. that will kind of set the marker for when and how this advances forward. We have been working to gather those interest groups that are willing to speak up and speak out about the significance of ratification of the Law of the Sea. And when you attend the hearings, you usually see a lot of stars on some pretty impressive shoulders. Our military leaders are in absolute agreement that this is an imperative for our country. That's an important part of the advocacy group. But we also need to be hearing from business interests, because they are impacted as we see an evolving Arctic. Those within the fishing industries, the maritime trades, there is such an interest that is at stake. So we've got to broaden the advocacy. So as we talk about how we can advance it, I would suggest that we need to make this an issue, not just to those areas where you've got water around you. It needs to be important in Iowa. It needs to be important in Vermont. And we need to talk about the national security implications. Think about what is happening right now in the Straits of Hormuz, and the tension and the concern. Look at the Sea of China and the issues that present themselves there. So this is not just about Alaska and Alaskan waters, but that's where our attention is. But that's why we can be such important advocates in this area. President has $8 million in his budget for an icebreaker design. $8 million, ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't get you the porthole. We've got a long way to go. But I do believe that we have made some good gains in awareness. But I think it's fair to say that we recognize that as an Arctic nation, it's almost an embarrassment to say that we don't have ice-breaking capacity as an Arctic nation. The Healy demonstrated her mettle, and we're very proud of that. But the fact of the matter is that she probably couldn't have done much more than what she did. She had an able crew. She had able pilots. And I am proud of our Alaska Marine pilots that helped navigate that. The Coast Guard was phenomenal. But we do not have a polar class icebreaker in the water today. And until the Polar Star comes back after her refurbishment in 2014, we won't. Our next-door neighbors, Russia, have 33. And it's not that we've got to keep up with the Joneses, but we've got to do a heck of a lot better than where we are now. So this is an imperative for me. We will keep working, but we need your help here. So now my questions are going to be longer than my speech. I will try to be more concise.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senator Murkowski, on behalf of your old district, my new district, thank you very much for making defense of the military a top priority as a senator. I'm disturbed at the news, as you are, but it seems it's going to be a long-term trend, not a couple budget cycles, but looking forward for 10 years, 20 years. What specific steps can the legislature take now that will help position Alaska for a long-term strategy of defending the economic and national security interests of the bases in Alaska?
It's an important question. 17% of our state's economy comes from the military. Up in the interior, 38%. 38%. John knows full well. It is huge. And so if you take, and I'll use the Eielson example because that's what we're all talking about right now, but if you take 1,500 personnel, if you take those men out, you take their families out, think about the hole in that interior economy. The real estate market, the schools, the retail establishments, everything. Just you think about the potential there. So, but it's not just about the strength of the interior, because we have an additional responsibility. We need to make sure that our taxpayer dollars, when it goes to fund our military, are being spent wisely, and that there is a strong strategy. I want these decisions to be strategy-driven and not budget-driven. And I'm afraid right now that this Eielson decision is budget-driven. And that concerns me. It concerns me because Alaska just costs more than anywhere else in the country when it comes to running our bases because of our high energy costs. And I don't care whether you're Eielson or Greeley or Elmendorf, it just costs us more. So if the military is really going to go down this road where it's all about how much it costs, we're not in a good position. So we need to remind the folks in the Pentagon, we need to remind everybody within DOD's structure of the significance that we hold. And we all know it. We say it all the time. We are sitting at the top of the world. We quote Billy Mitchell. We have it all. We've got the best training ranges. We can get to anywhere else in the world quicker than anyone else can. But we need to be more aggressive in reminding our military friends of that. We need to do all we can as communities and as a state to help with some of these initiatives. 33 other states were impacted by this decision from the Air Force. They're all rallying around, let me tell you, right now to figure out how they're going to save their aggressor squadrons, their A-10s, you know, whatever it is, the mission that has been singled out. It's going to be very competitive. We need to be competing with them. We need to have a plan. We need to have a proposal. The governor has a proposal, I understand, to hire a consultant, fair amount of money. We don't want to be aced out because we were not as on top of it and coordinating a strategy as we need to be. So I would urge you to work with him to try to figure out how we make that funding happen sooner than later. We can't wait until you guys get out of here in April. This is important. Give you one more takeaway, one more data point here. The Air Force military construction, the MILCON budget for the state in the president's budget is really ugly this year. We're at $18 million. $18 million for the MILCON budget. Think about that. Not nationally, here in the state. Okay. But let me give you another data point here. I got your attention on that, a couple of you. General Schwartz, when he was up on Friday and Saturday, said that within the Air Force budget, last year, the last fiscal year, Air Force MILCON was $1.6 billion. This year, the proposal is $440 million for the whole Air Force system. Of that $440 million, $160 of it is going to one Air Force base. I don't recall which one he said. So think about the precipitous drop in overall, I'm just talking Air Force now, what that's going to mean to us as a state. We need to have that longer-term vision where we work to advance all of our network of military installations. Because we're fighting Eielson today, who knows what we're going to be fighting coming down the road. So we got a lot of work to do. We'll do it.
Thank you, Senator. Just so you know, the what you have ahead of you, we have questions from Senator McGuire, Representative Millett, Representative Guerra, Representative Johnson, Representative Johansson, Senator Hoffman, and Representative Herron. So
I think that was a reprimand.
So we'll go with Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Lisa, welcome home. We're so honored that you serve us in D.C., but we're thrilled when you get to come back here to your home and the body that you served in so honorably. As a lawyer, I know that the revelations regarding the prosecutorial misconduct of our late Ted Stevens outraged you, especially as they related to the thwarting of the investigation of the young women that were being sexually abused, sadly, in a home in the gentleman to my right in I's district. So it touched us deeply. I would like you to briefly comment on that for Alaskans out there listening and for us here to know, what are you doing to ensure that no other Alaskan will be subject to that federal prosecutorial misconduct in the future?
Well, it is a subject that I think touches all of us, because Ted Stevens touched all of us. And what happened with that Department of Justice investigation was a travesty. It was a travesty to Ted Stevens, it was a travesty to his family, and to the system. Judge Sullivan, in his ruling that came out a month or so ago, I think noted the importance of making sure that there was transparency to this investigation, that as this was such a public proceeding, the public had a right to know what really went on in terms of that prosecution, in terms of what abuses really took place. And so I'm pleased that the judge has done that. I'm told that the results of the investigation, which are very weighty, will be released sometime in mid-March, and that is important, because that transparency is important. But I keep going back to the words in his opinion when he said that this violation of the process, this ill-gotten verdict, resulted in the loss of a seat for Ted Stevens. He lost his election because of that. But it tipped the balance of power in the United States Senate. It was an action by our government, by our Department of Justice, where they willfully advanced a prosecution. A prosecution is supposed to be about bringing about justice, not just bringing about a conviction. But they failed in that. And our government failed. And it tipped the balance of power in the United States Senate. And Ted Stevens is no longer with us. It is something that needs to be corrected. I am working on legislation that would require that exculpatory evidence in a proceeding be required to be provided to the defendant by the prosecution. This is something that many of the legal organizations back in Washington have been looking at. We need some changes. I think this case demonstrates how clearly we need some changes. The fact that the evidence was not produced because the judge did not direct them to do so, just it still stuns me. So we're going to try to right the wrong so that no Alaskan, no American would essentially be abused by the system that we all put faith and trust in.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Millett.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you, Senator Murkowski, for being here. I really appreciate all the hard work you do for Alaska. The issue that I'd like to bring to your attention is in the National Petroleum Reserve, we have 137 wells that were abandoned by the federal government between 1944 and 1981. They have been negligent in making those legacy wells meet just minimum requirements of safety. Some of the wells are missing. Some of the wells have an area around them that have many, many barrels of diesel that are spilling onto the tundra. We've met with the BLM. They say that their plan is one well a year. It's 137 years from now that that mess will be cleaned up. How can we help you as a legislature to encourage the federal government in this hypocrisy where they won't let us develop our natural resources because they're afraid of the damage that we might do to the land when they've actually come and desecrated the land themselves? So I'm looking for some direction from you on how to motivate them to speed up the wells and make them whole again.
Well, you want an action plan, let's raise hell. I mean, this is just wrong. It's just wrong. And they just can't handle the fact that they have turned their head to the responsibility. And yet, as you point out, they won't let you walk anywhere up there without 16 permits. And yet they have failed in their environmental stewardship in a way that is so egregious. So 137 wells, what I'm told is that seven have been cleaned. Seven have been righted. When I asked how much is this going to cost, because it's all about cost, it's all about priorities right now, and we understand that, I was told that if they were to take the 37 that are the worst, and when I say worst, I mean really in danger of causing some problems for us, causing some problems for the federal government, then it's really going to cost money. But if they were to take the 37 that are in most immediate need, it would be somewhere between $40 and $50 million to address that. That's a chunk of change. We understand that. But one a year is not sufficient. It is not adequate. It is offensive, in my opinion. We've raised this issue. We need you all as individual legislators and collectively to keep raising this. I've got a conference call with Secretary Salazar tomorrow, and I'm going to tell him, address the legislature. They're ticked off. What are you going to do about it? Where is it in the budget? What is it that you're going to do? Because for all of the constraints that your department and all of the others are putting on us, we're trying to be responsible stewards of the environment. We're not trying. We are responsible stewards of the environment. You have an obligation to do the same. So I think we just need to get a little vocal. Join me.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Senator. I think you didn't get an applause because you kept your speech to 15 minutes. You got an applause because people here like you. So.
Thank you, Les.
An issue that's been very important to me, to my constituents, and I think if you look at the polling nationwide, has been the Supreme Court's decision a few years ago on Citizens United. And that allows corporations and unions to make unlimited independent expenditures to get people elected and unelected. There are two ways to address it. We've done one here where we require the top three donors to disclose themselves in political ads. That helps. In Congress, that was filibustered, unfortunately, in 2009 and failed by one vote. So one of my questions is that something you could support on the congressional level, requiring the top three, top five donors in an independent expenditure to reveal themselves so at least the public knows where the money's coming from? And then that, and then the more important thing, a reversal of Citizens United. There's sort of a national movement to call for a constitutional amendment to reverse Citizens United so states and Congress can decide whether corporations and unions should be able to make unlimited expenditures. I mean, right now, that money, you know, Exxon, when it takes in $40 billion a year in profits, drowns out every single member of my district. My district can't keep up with that, and it takes away the concept of one person, one vote. So on those two issues, a constitutional amendment. Is that something you think you could support to roll back Citizens United? And if not, at least requiring the top three or top five donors to reveal themselves on political ads so we know who's really funding these things. What's your opinion on those two things?
Well, I appreciate you bringing it up. We're seeing this play out across the nation as we speak. The dollars that are at play in this national election are nothing short of phenomenal. And, you know, all sides are guilty here. Everyone's jumping in because all of a sudden it's unlimited. And it is, in this day and age when we're all talking about transparency and openness in government and disclosure, and we all as elected officials have signed on and said that's a good thing, the result of this decision takes us so far back that we have got to correct it. Now, in terms of whether or not disclosure of the top three names is the right way to do it or whether it needs to be more, I'm not sure, but what I am sure of is that we have to address the issue, because if we continue to do this, there's no reason that anyone's going to give money to Lisa Murkowski, candidate for U.S. Senate, because you're going to be limited, and you're going to have to disclose, and there is a perfectly legal venue where you can give as much or as little as you want, and there's no disclosure whatsoever. For lots of different reasons, people don't like to disclose. Well, for lots of good reasons, we need to disclose. So here's where I am on Citizens United. If we can figure out a way that legislatively we can require greater disclosure, we need to do that, and we need to do it soon. It's not going to happen this year because everyone's vested in the money-making machines that are going on right now. We need to get on the other side of this election, and we need to correct that. I think what you're going to see is a kind of a movement across the country where people say, well, wait a minute. I'm all about, you know, freedom of speech and the ability to donate whatever it is that I want, but I'm sure uncomfortable about what we saw with the level of money in this presidential campaign. I think they're seeing it full blown. And I stand before you as a beneficiary of a super PAC. With my race in 2010, I was one of the first ones where there was an organization that came together and lawfully used the outcome of Citizens United to do some incredible fundraising for me. I stood to gain from that. But I also recognize that as Alaskans, that as Americans, it's only appropriate that you know where the money's coming from. We can do a better job, and I think the decision that we're now living with is not a good one for the system. It's not a good one for the process. I think one of the things that it does is it allows more money into political campaigns than any of us dreamed possible. I don't know about you, but when I'm fighting for $3 million to get into appropriations bill for water and sewer projects, or if you're fighting in your district to get $500,000 for a community project that's really going to make a difference, and you see $5 million being raised in one coffee, one little reception, with unlimited checks being written, something's wrong with this picture. So I appreciate the direction that the legislature is going on this. We need to be doing more disclosure, not less.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Welcome back, Senator. And enjoy your next couple days down in Ketchikan. I know they'll be happy to see you. I have, a two-part question, but they are related, so I hope the President doesn't get too upset. First of all, you spoke about the current playing field with ANWR, the bill moving out of the House, and I don't think anybody's under the impression that it will get out of the Senate or be signed by the President at this point. But what I'd like you to touch on is the value of a constant engagement from the legislature and the state to lay the groundwork for maybe in 2 years, maybe in 4 years, that when the decision is made, We already have those contacts. People are comfortable with our position. So the first part is to talk about that, and also the OCS is also another issue that was in the bill. So both of those, the value of a constant engagement and what we can do as a state. And then related to that, when we are successful and those projects come online, can you touch a little bit about how Alaska needs to move forward to provide those support services in the maritime industry? A lot of our business is going to be done in the Gulf or down on the West Coast, and we want it to be in Alaska. Obviously, you're familiar with the ship and dry dock in Ketchikan. But can you talk about how those two go together and what we can do to build that maritime industry, which will also, once it's built, allow us to get some of that business in the fishing industry that currently goes down to Seattle, that whole structure of Alaska as a leader in the maritime industry on the West Coast. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Well, and they do dovetail, so I appreciate that. Insofar as ongoing education efforts, we can't sit back and assume that people know, because they don't. We've got new crops of congressmen coming in every year, just as you do, or every other year, same on the Senate. And the fact of the matter is even if you've been educated on ANWR in the past, there's new stuff that's coming up. People need to know some of the progress that we have made. They need to also understand some of the challenges that we continue to face. So I don't think that we should assume that, well, because that legislator or that senator voted in support of opening ANWR back in 95, we don't need to go back and touch them again. We need them to be really strong advocates for us. I'm going to be bringing a group of members up north this summer on an ANWR-specific trip, and we're looking at both sides of the aisle. We're looking at new members and old members, but it's an effort, again, to just remind them of the value, if they have forgotten, but for those who've not ever really had that complete connection, we're going to make sure that it is available for them. When you talk about the opportunities within the maritime industry, whether it's ANWR or development of our offshore resources, these are jobs, folks. I mean, you know that. Alaska is not doing as bad as the rest of the country, but what kind of a goal is that? We're not as bad as the highest unemployment since World War II? Slight solace. We need to be doing what we can as a state to create good jobs and good opportunities for our families. And it's there within the maritime industry, as we would service vessels coming up and back, hopefully build some in our great shipyard there. But we've got opportunities for the job creation end of resource development, not only up north on the slope, but positioned throughout our state. So this is something that should be a no-brainer for us in terms of our advocacy. But again, I don't think that we should assume that anybody has all the facts on this. So keep it up. I know you've got Energy Council coming up. A group of you were back a couple weeks ago. I met with a good group of you. Your advocacy is important.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. President. I stand before you today concerned about the high cost of energy in Alaska. There are many issues that are on Alaska's plates, but I believe that the high cost of energy is one of the top issues, if not the top issue, facing Alaska. This last winter, we've seen the coldest winter in over a decade. At the same time, we've seen the highest costs of energy throughout the state of Alaska. Everyone knows that this year we are going to see that the price of oil, for the first time in the state's history, averaging over $100 a barrel. I've read reports that some areas of the state have seen heating oil costs go up over 24%. We've seen in another region of the state, the heating degree days go up by 22%. That's a double whammy to the citizens of Alaska. Many of them are facing the fact that they're spending over 40% of their disposable income on energy. You mentioned LIHEAP and the fight there, but the fact of the matter is that program is under jeopardy. The state is doing what it can. We had testimony just this morning that one individual had to pay over $150 for 20 gallons of heating fuel. This, I believe, is outrageous. But what the state of Alaska has done many things, and we continue to march down that road. But I continue to think that the cost of energy is at the top of Alaska's plates. And I was wondering, since I heard a few days ago that the cost of gasoline in California has hit over $5 a gallon. So it's an issue. I think that high energy costs are something that's on everybody's mind. But what can the federal government do to assist us when energy costs are at the top of many people's agenda? Thank you.
Well, Lyman, I appreciate you bringing it up. It is the number one issue across the state for families, for businesses, and for us as Alaskans. I was in Yakutat yesterday. Yakutat pays 54 cents a kilowatt hour before PCE, about 30 cents a kilowatt hour afterwards. But they are went to the store. The store is paying in January. They paid over $10,000 a month for their electricity, for their utilities. You know, when you think about all the issues that we've talked about here today, the military, the strength of our military, and the presence, the continued presence, may be in jeopardy because we've got extraordinarily high energy costs. When you think about, you know, how we're going to advance some of our projects, whether they're transportation or in other sectors, it all comes down to our high costs. When you think about how we work to attract more business to the slope, one of the things that they face is, gosh, it's expensive to do business in Alaska. This is our Achilles heel. Energy is our Achilles heel, and if we fail to be more aggressive in how we help our communities, have no choice. I mean, we're seeing people moving in from the villages in your area, particularly, Senator Hoffman. They're coming to town because they can't afford to live where they were born and where their parents were born. So how do we deal with it now? Your point about what's happening outside is an important one. The price of crude this morning was $106.39. The national average today at the pump is $3.61 a gallon, but the forecast is over $4 by end of the month, next month. But this is a 41-cent increase over the past year. We've seen this price spike. It was 13-cent increase in just a month at the price of the pump. So it is getting the attention of people around the country. It's grabbed our attention for years now, decades now. But it's one of those issues where I think we know you have a price spike, and then it goes down, and everybody forgets about it. And then energy is not front and center. So the issue that we face in the Congress is, what can we do today to make a difference? And I think we need to stop framing it in the what can we do today to make a difference today. It's what can we do today to make a difference tomorrow. Because if we had moved ahead back in 1995, when we moved it through the House and moved it through the Senate, if it hadn't been vetoed at that time, we would be sitting here with a pipeline that is closer to being full than being less than half full right now. In 1995, the price at the pump was $1.07 a gallon. And at that time, it was said, well, we can't move this through because it's not going to affect prices now because it's going to take 10 years to get online. If we have that attitude that we can't act today because it doesn't yield immediate benefit today, we're never going to get anywhere. So the reminder is we've got to be acting now. We've got some opportunities. The president has, I believe, turned a complete blind eye on the Keystone XL pipeline. That only not brings oil from Canada, but it also brings oil from Montana and North Dakota, where right now they're trucking it to get down into the pipeline systems in the lower 48 there. So we're putting our own oil, our own domestic oil, at risk by failing to move on that. We've got a situation coming in where we're moving into the summer season here shortly. We've got some refineries that switch out from the winter blends to the summer blends. You know, maybe we need to look to how we might give a waiver so that we can actually keep our refineries moving that product so that it helps to make a difference there at the pump. There's some little things that we can do. One of the things that we should not do and is being discussed today is we should not be dipping into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve just to kind of let some of the air out of the balloon on prices. That is a temporary relief, if it gives relief at all. But I am very concerned. I'm very concerned about what's going on in Iran. I think they might just be crazy enough to block the Straits of Hormuz. And when that happens, then you have a supply disruption. That is real. Nigeria, Sudan, look at where we rely on our sources of oil right now. This is not the place that we want to be banking our dollars. So the possibility that we will face a true supply disruption is real. And when that happens, we need to have the reserves in the SPRO so that we can access them for the purpose for which it was intended. But right now there's a little bit of politics going on. I know you're shocked to hear me say that, but it is very real. And if that were to happen, think about what it does to Alaska. Because we're at the end of the chain up here for so many different reasons. Out in Yakutat yesterday, we're talking about what it takes to fill up your boat and go out and catch the winter kings. Talking to the guy at the processing facility about what it costs him to just make the ice to keep the fish chilled. I mean, the energy is going to kill us if we don't get a hold of it. So what do? We keep pushing on ANWR. We keep pushing on OCS. We keep pushing on NPRA. We keep doing good things in Cook Inlet. We keep, as a legislature, the eye on the ball when it comes to what it is that we need to do to be that partner to ensure that we've got not only the jobs but the resource coming out of the north. A lot of work here. A lot of work here. I'm over my time, but we end on the issue that I think is most critical to us as a state and to our success and to the well-being of our families. Communities like Yakutat, communities like those you represent in the YK Delta, cannot continue to pay 40 to 45% of their income just to keep warm and to move. And that's what's happening right now. We as a state have options. We need to invest in ourselves. That renewable energy deployment fund that you have out there, let's gear it up. Let's get some projects going. I want a good wave project off of Yakutat. That's my latest pitch to you this morning. I'm going to ramble, so you better rein me in, Mr. President, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for the meeting.
This special broadcast of U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's annual address to the Alaska State Legislature has been produced by 360 North and KTOO News in Juneau. Thank you for joining us.